Are you the quantum mechanics?
Yes, we're the quantum mechanics. We're the paranormal podcast for the believers, the doubters, and everyone in between. And a slight apology, if I do go a bit croaky during this episode, just getting over a bit of a kind of, I'll call it man flu, cold, cough, whatever you want to call it. It must feel like to everybody listening to this podcast that either me or you are permanently ill, right?
I know. I don't know why it keeps happening. Is it like maybe we should take more Barocca? I don't know.
Yeah, I know. So, no, I should be fine. But if I, last night I lost my voice completely, but it is back today. So, fingers crossed.
You just sound like gravelly and more Barry Whitey.
Yeah. Tommy Vance. I'm going for the Tommy Vance.
Oh, Tommy Vance, the Nightfly.
Yeah.
Oh, that takes me back. Is he still with us?
No, he's not. I used to work with Tommy Vance, actually. He was such a lovely man. He did my answer phone message at work once.
Amazing.
It was brilliant just to have it. I can't remember what he said. He was like, you've reached the desk of Peter. He's not at his desk, he's under it. But when he gets up, he'll call you back. Obviously, I can't do his voice justice.
No,
but
no.
Yeah, what an amazing man.
Oh, nice.
Man. Yeah.
Well, I haven't got anything that I can really segue into that.
From Tommy Vance.
From Tommy Vance, no. No. So I have got an interesting topic this week. You know how, like, I think my personal pet obsession, apart from werewolves, is UFOs?
Yep.
This is sort of UFO-y, but kind of not. And it all starts with the airship flap of 1896 and 1897. Have you come across this at all?
Yes, this is the, I can never get the name right, the airship club. I love this.
Sedona.
Sedona, yes. This is all, it's all very cyberpunky and...
It is.
Yeah.
And so this has been a bit of a mystery, and there's a very specific mystery which possibly may have been solved. But let's kind of start at the beginning. If you are not, as in you, the listener, are not familiar with this, let me take you back. So probably one of the most prominent writers on this, who is also one of my favourite podcasters, Micah Hanks from the Micah Hanks Show, he wrote an interesting little piece, and he was talking about how a lot of the predecessors to modern UFO sightings are often sort of put aside in people's minds as newspaper hoaxes,
right,
or at least yellow journalism. And he says that the 1890s airship flaps, they have so much absurdity about them that sometimes it's hard not to think that they were put around by journalists, sort of trying to make up a story. He points out one which I had never come across. This is my favourite. There was a farmer who came across one of these landed ships, and whose occupants, a man and a woman, were apparently naturists on their planet and enjoyed a bit of nude sunbathing as they indicated to the amazed farmer about their extraterrestrial origins. And so when you have stories like that...
I love that. Know, I just got this vision of one of them going, you couldn't just like lather up my back for me, could you?
Just doing a bit of volleyball down on Earth. Yeah. But it's that idea that rather than being a breakaway civilization from Earth or indeed a secret aero club, they're extraterrestrials.
Right.
And the big question, well, the big question that has been sort of making people scratch their head up until, well, now really, but there's part of this that I'm going to come on and answer in a bit, is did the technology to build airships like this even exist in the 1890s?
Yeah.
Now, yes, Micah says, yes, it is interesting that some of the technology did exist. And this will be highlighted in a book I'm going to be talking about in a bit. But he points out that most of these, the airship sightings, happen around the San Francisco area and the California area. So kind of bear that in mind as we go forward.
I always feel we end up with two theories about this, don't we? It's almost either it's secret technology of the time that people are seeing and maybe misidentifying as something extraterrestrial, or in some ways it's extraterrestrials trying to fit in with the technology but being a bit ahead of the time. They're the two main theories, aren't they?
That's right. What you said was absolutely right, the cyberpunk element to it, and that is really going to come to the fore in a bit.
Yeah.
But Micah points out that there is this guy, Charles Abbott Smith, who has a patent for an airship design that comes back to the 1890s, and he was a San Francisco inventor, and he was trying to raise money to build this ship.
Yeah.
Nobody knows whether he built it or not. It seems most likely that he didn't. it feels like there's evidence, but there's evidence of knowledge, but there are key parts about this that don't add up. And very specifically, it's what they would have filled it with and how they would have powered it. Those are the two things to kind of hang on to.
Right. So the gas that would get it to go up, basically, and how you would propel it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then the relationship between the UFO reports, the idea of whether they come from an extraterrestrial origin, whether it is an earthly origin, all of those things. And there's been so many people that have written about them. In fact, I must credit Richard Dolan, I think, is the person that first spoke about breakaway civilization. So this idea that there is some black money being either channeled from a government or an organization, some could say the Illuminati, you know, that is going into funding these things, but they want to keep the technology safe and secret for themselves.
So this is a part of, or like you say, breakaway, or part of a terrestrial society, let's call it, that has advanced technology but is somehow suppressing it in order to kind of remain under the radar, something like that?
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly right. If we carry with us this idea that everyone thinks that it could be a hoax, and then I found this wonderful book, The Secrets of Del Shao, by Dennis Crenshaw, I'm sorry, and he wrote a whole story about this. So it starts with the mission of this Sonora Aero Club apparently was to design and build the first navigable aircraft using a mysterious gas called NB gas for lift and propulsion. Mm. And these flying machines were called Aeros. And this gentleman, Del Shao, made no claims that he was a pilot, but he was the official craftsman and scribe for the club because of his artistic ability. Yeah. He never drew himself aboard an Aero, but he illustrated a large number of designs, over 100, and named the airships. There's one called the Aero Trump, pleasingly.
Really?
Yes, and apparently it's described as being very annoying. I'll just leave that out there. But also the Aero Schnabel, the Aero Mary, and Del Shao drawings also illustrated this heroic Peter Menis, who is a pilot of the Aero Goose and inventor of the NB gas.
Was that his real name?
Well, we don't even know if
Peter Menis.
We don't even know he existed.
I might start adopting that as my name, Peter Menis. That's quite cool.
It's enigmatic, isn't it?
People would remember you, wouldn't you, if you introduced yourself? What's your name, Peter Menis?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. What's he like? I don't know. He's a bit of a menace.
Yeah. He's a lovely guy.
So it's true that Del Shao existed, but the rest of it we're not sure about. Right. But it is incredibly compelling. So let me just take you to how we got to the statement that I've just made. And it all starts on a dump in about 1968.
Right.
And there's a group of people going through this tip in Texas, and a gentleman finds this stash of what he describes as colouring books. And as he brings them back to his car, there's a very fortunate gentleman called Fred Washington, who is kind of like, he's a trader, he does up antiques, he's kind of like a bit of a wheeler dealer as well, and he spots these books that are going into the car and pays $100 for them.
Right.
And he's got a good number there, he's got 11, and it's not long before there's a gentleman called Pete Navarro, who is a co-author of this book. He takes an interest because three of the books in Fred's possession are exhibited at St. Thomas's University. And it's such a coincidence how that happens. So Fred, who has this sort of shed of workshoppiness, is the best way of describing it. There's a much better description in the book, but it kind of goes on for pages. These students come down from the university and they're putting on an exhibition of flight in art. Right. And he says, I've got this. You know, this is pretty unique. And they have these incredible pictures of aero ships that, you know, are unlike anything that you would have found in published books. And of course, these students are delighted. And so in 1968, they take them back and they're on display at the university.
And are these, in my mind, I'm picturing these as almost kind of Jules Verne-esque type drawings.
They are exactly Jules Verne-esque type drawings.
They still exist. We can see them.
You still get, but unfortunately the books are pulled. They're not together in a collection anymore. So Pete really is the first and last person to see them all in their collective environment, you know, the way that they were originally created by Dalshow.
We'll put some images of those on our Patreon site. So if you go to patreon.com/TQMpod, we'll put some of those pictures up there.
Pete is not your average book collector, though. He had an experience, and this is why he was so fascinated by what he saw at the university. He relates, shortly after dark, on a quiet midsummer night in 1932, three young boys had just crossed a vacant lot in front of their homes and were walking along the next street over. They were heading for a small drugstore to buy some candy and bubblegum. The section of East Houston where they lived was sparsely populated and not as busy as it would be today. On that particular night, the streets were very quiet with no other people in sight. As they walked along the tree-lined street, clowning around as small boys do, they crossed a shallow ditch in order to take a shortcut to the store. A strange, shimmering, round object appeared in the night sky above them, next to a large pine tree. It scared the two younger boys so badly that they immediately ran away down the path. But 12-year-old Pete Navarro was more curious than afraid, and he stood his ground, wondering what this strange light could be. His first thought was it might be someone up a tree playing a joke on passers-by, shining a spotlight at them. But then he realised it couldn't be. The light had instantly disappeared, and there was no one there. And this is the beginning of this guy's fascination with the UFO genre. In 1968, it's not the same as it was today. It's much more niche and nuanced, and of course you don't have the internet, so he becomes fascinated by trying to collect material that might inform him about that night and what he saw.
And at that night, does he describe the craft, whatever it is that he sees? Is this that kind of cyber?
It's just a light.
Right, okay.
It's just a light.
So it's not particularly detailed, but he saw something he couldn't explain.
He did, yeah. He did. And he also, because he was in his line of work, he also, as well as being an artist, he ran a reprographics company, and he came across a lot of old newspaper articles, including ones about the strange California airships. And this is what prompted him, when he sees these images that are on display, he puts two and two together and thinks, well, it's the same time frame. Maybe I could get closer to understanding what this mystery could be. That's how he gets involved. But he can't buy the books. So unfortunately, he goes to go and see Fred Washington. And Fred is an amiable chap. And initially, Pete gets a look at them and says, can I buy them? But because he's already sold three at $500 a piece, for the next eight, he wants another $500 a piece.
Right.
He hasn't got that sort of money. And he points out that his wife would kill him if she thought he was even paying a quarter of that.
Okay.
He can't raise $1,000. But he comes up with this plan that Fred, being the nice chap he is, he says, you can come and see these books anytime you like, but you can't make a copy of them and they can't leave my building. So that's what he does. He makes extensive notes and revisits the manuscripts regularly, trying to recreate the amazing images he's seeing just by sketching them. But he is an artist, so he can do pretty accurate sketches. And Fred actually pulls him up on this and says, you know, are you going to go and sell those? Because they're worth something. He's like, no. They're for my own use, and I will share them amongst friends. And Fred's like, okay, that's fine, but will you write me in on any profits you make out of them? Fred is trying to protect this investment that he's made, because he sees, you know, very rarely does he have something this valuable in his possession.
Well, I guess he could pass them off as being original, couldn't he? But it'd be tough to tell, wouldn't it?
Yeah. As he goes through these very detailed technical drawings of flying machines that date back to the early 1800s, Pete begins to think that this guy, Dalshow, might know something. And so he just doesn't know who he is, though. But he manages to find where he used to live. and he goes and visits the people that live there. And first of all, he's trying to find out, you know, where does this guy come from? And they discover, well, he used to come from, he originates from Germany. He moved to Houston, but it's possible, yes, that he did used to live in California.
Right.
And so he thinks, okay, that's really interesting. But off the artwork that he's found, and bearing in mind that it is full of notes, but they're in code, one of the things that he's managed to pull off there is this note about Sonora. And so he goes on a mission to try and find, you know, maybe could Dao Xiao's story be true? Is there a place called Columbia in California? He's got Sonora. He can't find Columbia until he then goes, gets a detailed map, right, there's Columbia. So he starts thinking, okay, this is could be a real place.
Right.
This could be a real thing. And so this gives him the incentive to go back and delve into these mysterious symbols in this book. And I've got some photographs in front of me to remind myself how weird they are. They look very much like, I don't know, it's a cross between hieroglyphics and shorthand.
Right.
And are not very easy to discern. And it's mixed with English and other like random symbols in there. But now he's got it in his head that Dao Xiao could be writing about something real.
Just so I'm clear, these symbols, are these part of the artwork that he's looking
They're
at?
Mixed in with the artwork.
Right, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got these almost drawn pictures of some kind of flying machine, and then there's these weird symbols and stuff like that, and then little bits of information that could be locations, all kinds of stuff in there. He's basically trying to solve a puzzle through these artwork, basically, yeah?
He is. Yeah. And he becomes, it's a bit like, we've spoken about it before, Kit Williams and the search for the golden hair.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. And he believes that Dao Xiao has hidden some kind of secret knowledge within this book. As it turns out, as he gets closer and closer to realizing there's something buried in there, he, through various means, he does actually end up being able to buy the books off Fred.
Right.
And Pete's brother, Rudolph, gets obsessed with the books as well, and they start working on them together. And one of the things that attracts both of them as they get into it are these really strange press clippings. So he calls them press blooms. There are like presentations of clippings, and we're not even sure if they're real newspaper articles. But there's one that he highlights in the book, which is called Escaped in a Balloon. And it's the story of how a pickpocket is chased by an airship. And the aeronaut, as he calls it, manages to apprehend the pickpocket. And he just thinks, well, this is, why would you have these press clippings in there? Why would you make up these things? It's such a head scratcher.
But also, you know, I've been in a hot air balloon. They just go where they want to go, pretty much, right? You always have like a Land Rover or something following them around for when you do land that they can, you know, it's not. So the idea of chasing a pickpocket on the ground, that's some maneuverability, right?
Well, this is the thing, is because you're right. Air balloons were completely possible at that point. It's the idea of lighter than air powered flight.
Yeah.
And you've picked up on a good point, because the suggestion in that article is that it's a powered, maneuverable flight. You've got an aeronaut who is able to pursue a pickpocket.
Yeah.
And this makes him point out something which this is one of the greatest things that I learned from this book. We all think, I mean, I did, that the Wright brothers made their first manned controlled flight near Kitty Hawk,
yeah,
1903. Well, he says, and I checked this out, it does appear to be true, he says the honour of the first to fly controlled flight should actually go to a Brazilian, Santos Dumont, who flew a bright yellow dirigible powered by a small gasoline engine and controlled by a rudder in France in 1898.
Yeah.
Apparently he covered a distance of 7 miles. So he went from St. Cloud to as far as where the Eiffel Tower would be.
That's a proper flight. That's for the Wright
minutes.
Brothers, isn't it?
Yeah. The Wright brothers did 7 minutes.
Yeah.
And 820 feet.
Yeah.
So that was a gasoline engine stuck to a dirigible in 1898.
Wow.
If this is possible, then if that is possible, then maybe, you know, 50 years before him, maybe some other people were experimenting and had got somewhere.
Yeah.
So again, they start going into this, and he pulls up this newspaper clipping again. Not that is cited in a Dalshow book, but he finds it. November 17th, 1896, a large object seen by many people as it flew over Sacramento, capital city of California. Sacramento lies a very short distance to the west of where the Aero Club's alleged home base of Sonora is. So he thinks, okay, I'm really onto something here. And he gets quite breathless about the whole thing. But the big mystery is, of course, I keep saying, how it was powered. As Pete goes through the codes, he gets names, locations, design details, like literally names of people who are in the Aero Club. Yes, yes. He points out that the chap who developed the fuel apparently was a big drinker. That was a problem. You know, there's right. details about who all these people are. But this mysterious substance that powers it, both in terms of lift and propulsion, NB gas, which appears to be created in some kind of chamber where one chemical is dropped into another. And I've got a picture of it here. It looks like, from the side, at the back end of it, it looks almost like a jet engine. And in the middle is a turning device. And he describes there's a trap door at the top. And into that trap door comes some kind of chemical that goes around this turning device and gets dropped into some kind of liquid, it looks like, below in a small chamber, so a chamber about half the size of a person. He looks to have illustrated what looks like an engine that is sort of creating fuel and then burning it.
And these are in those books, are they?
These are in those books, yes. And he also describes the direction of the motor. This one is attached to the Aero Goose, because of course the Aero Goose is flown by the guy who developed this fuel.
Right.
And for a long time, the sticking point has been, so if the Sonora Aero Club existed, if any of this is possible, what were they using as this fuel, and what is NB gas? It sounds like a made-up thing, doesn't it? It doesn't sound quite realistic.
Although quite a lot of detail to put into that document. I was just thinking hoax in my mind. It's quite a complex, detailed hoax, and one that needs to play out over a number of years if you're going to hoax. I mean, I guess it could just have been a almost Jules Verne fantasy that somebody's interpreting as real. But, yeah. And having said that, I've read... I don't know if you've ever read Edgar Allan Poe's sci-fi. There's one about a trip to the moon. It's almost unreadable because of the amount of scientific... you know, faux scientific information about how this rocket gets to the moon and how it all works. It's, you almost stop reading it because there's so much detail. So I guess that is a possibility, that it's a work of fiction that maybe never came to light and it's being interpreted as a work of fact. But it's interesting, though.
Well, I think that is what a lot of people thought it was. It was, people do still think that there is... I can't stress enough, there is no proof that the Sonora Aero Club actually existed or any of these machines got built or any of these people, apart from Dalshow, absolutely existed. But if they didn't, it's an incredible work of fiction because, like you said, like the Jules Verne things, what he's done is create... It's a record of what appears to be real. It's not a story. He isn't saying... Yeah. that we did this or we did that. The story elements appear to be in these press cutting, the blooms, as he calls them.
Yeah. So the sightings that you've quoted, they're from that book source. They're not separate. I know they're not, they've not been created by whoever created the book. They've been kind of put into the book. But
yes,
everything's coming from the book, the same source, right?
Everything's coming from the same source. Okay. Yes, yes, yes. And that's when... So I sort of know this story, and I backwards engineered it because then I came across this gentleman called Dr. Brett Cohen, PhD, who wrote this very intriguingly titled The Mystery of NB Gas Solved, an Aero Airship Flight.
Ooh.
Could the airships described by American artist Charles Dalshow be powered by an anti-gravity fuel source of ammonia gas?
So when we say anti-gravity, are we... Are we going Bob Lazar here?
No. So this is the thing that... So in the code, in the Dalshau manuscripts, he calls it anti-gravity gas. What he means is lighter than air gas. It's quite confusing.
Like helium or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that when I read anti-gravity, I am sort of taken up by the current meaning of anti-gravity, which is some kind of, you're right, Bob Lazar engine inside a recovered spacecraft that somehow bends gravity and time.
Yeah, time and space, and then you just kind of almost Star Trek-like, just warp out and appear somewhere, yeah.
And it's a good point, because when we talk about just balloon flight, which was absolutely possible, even in the Regency period, 1810,
yeah,
there were rich inventors in the UK, France, America, who are, you know, they're doing all sorts of experiments. There's like these Doc Brown type figures who have got together enough money to do an airship, and they become sort of like heroes of their time. They get all the girls because they've got these very exciting airships.
Yeah.
Some of them refer to them as anti-gravity, and I think that's because of the sexy connotations of the term.
Yeah.
But a lot of them just say lighter than air balloons.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know if you know, but local to us in Oxford, the Botanical Gardens in Oxford, there used to be a tethered balloon there in the 1800s that you could use to go and observe the gardens.
Oh, I didn't know
Yes,
that.
They used to let people up and down, and that is before the 1897. So this is what we're really talking about, is like airships, air balloons would not have been uncommon. They were used in the Napoleonic Wars, unbelievably.
Yeah.
It's this notion of powered flight.
Yeah.
So if I get back to our doctor there, so he says, quite rightly, according to Dalshau, one of the members of the Sonora Aero Club had discovered a formula for anti-gravity fuel. And the formula went to the grave with the death of Peter Menes, the character from the books who apparently invented the formulation, but was taken by the strong drink.
Was that part of the formula?
Well, yes, I did wonder. But he says there were many speculations for the exact formula of NB gas. And he speculates it could have been neon gas. And one of the reasons that it could have been neon gas is because the symbol NE, strangely close to it, neon is a lighter than air gas and it will lift a balloon. However, it is relatively rare on Earth and it would require considerable expense to produce enough neon gas to even lift a craft.
Pretty unlikely you could replicate that or create it in a chamber that's half the size of a human being.
Absolutely. It also has another disadvantage. It was not discovered until 1898, or at least by mainstream science. It wasn't discovered until 1898. And the Sonora Aero Club apparently disbanded in the 1860s.
I like the idea, though, that the byproduct of this thing is liquid malt whiskey, and that's where the drink comes in.
Liquid malt whiskey. That's all it emits.
Yeah.
Now, don't you think they'd have sold a lot more, like, Nissan Leafs?
Yeah, if that's what it emitted.
If a lovely glass of Jura came out of the back.
You'd have a little kind of, you know, hip flask at the back of your exhaust, wouldn't you?
I certainly would.
Yeah.
NB gas could also be helium gas.
I was thinking helium.
Because that has a chemical symbol of HE again.
Quite rare, very though, similar. As well, isn't it, helium?
It is.
On
it
this
is.
Planet.
It is, but and also quite difficult to use as a fuel.
Yeah.
Helium is twice as heavy as hydrogen, and hydrogen has more buoyancy than helium. So, you know, it could have been either of those things.
I always like that joke that people who've come across like in a cave or whatever, a deposit of helium gas because it's so rare, just going, we're rich.
It's very hard to do an impression of yourself on helium gas, isn't it? Have you noticed that?
Yeah, no, it is, especially when you've got a cold.
But you can only do it when you've actually got some.
Yeah.
And apparently that's not very good for you. But that was we were allowed to do it as kids when we had party balloons, yeah.
That was the best bit about a party balloon,
It really was, yeah. He also points out that after that speculation on what gas it could be, there are limited chemical possibilities for a solid mixed with water, as described in the diagram by Dalshau, to produce a gas that would be lighter than air. And he's right. Like, none of those gases that he was just talking about there could be made mid-flight and then burnt.
Well, this was the other thing I was thinking. It's like, given the size of the, you know, half a human size of where whatever this process is going on, it's like, how far does that get you? Do you know what I mean? How much, how big's your fuel tank in that sense? What do you have to take to make it work?
Right, right. Well, he thinks, after lots and lots of equations that are presented to me, which I was beginning to think maybe I should tell you about, and then I thought, if I don't understand them, yeah, no, what is the point? He said, it is proposed by me, not me, him, the findings of the author, that ammonia gas, which is NH3, could be produced from a simple mixture of two solids, ammonium chloride and sodium hydroxide, dissolved completely in water and allowed to react. Ammonia gas is lighter than air, and it can be, you know, used as a gas fuel, and it could be the elusive NB gas, which could lift and propel the aero airships as described in the document. So he thinks that this is what the NB gas is.
But you would have, if I'm right, you would have to take that solid with you on your journey, right?
You would, but and it's
almost,
possible.
Almost like coal, just keep putting it into the engine.
Absolutely. And this is what that diagram appears to look like.
Right.
Now, it would have been very dangerous. So it's kind of incredibly dangerous to breathe this in. And apparently, well, we all know what ammonia smells like. He points out that we, as humans, we can smell ammonia way before it becomes dangerous.
Right.
So we can smell it one part in 15 million. And we know how dangerous that is, because ammonia is present in things like decay and urine and things like that. Yeah. But he said if they'd found a way of containing it and controlling the process to from like creation to burn, this could be our mysterious NB gas. And again, it's NH3, NB, it's a code, NH3, the H and the 3 speculates, you know, that's coming together to form this B. It's kind of his little nod and a wink to, that's what it is, you know.
Well, I guess if you're going with it as the inventor and the author doing these books, you'd want to have some secrecy, wouldn't you? You wouldn't want to give away your code or your formula too easy.
No, exactly. Well, this is very much the point. And so he points out that this is a supposedly a secret club made up not just of wealthy people, but a sort of a collection of scientists and like-minded inventors who want to create something for their own means, perhaps with the thought of selling it on,
yeah,
but mainly because
they can.
Because they can, yes. Which is, you know, we've heard this many, many times. This sort of gentleman's club,
yeah,
idea of keeping it to yourself.
Well, it's reminded me of, you know, expeditions, thinking of around the world in 80 days, you know, Phileas Fogg. It's always at the gentleman's club, isn't it, that there's some bet or some agreement, or, you know, the one we did on carnivorous plants, you know, people kind of funding these expeditions. It's not so much of they can see profit in the future. It's just a jolly good thing to do, isn't it?
It's just a jolly good thing to do, exactly. One of the things that really I was confused about was, like, if they were real, why did they end up on a tip?
Yeah.
Well, and I imagine, I wanted to answer that because I imagine lots of people are going, well, how come they found them on a tip? Well, it turns out that after Dao Xiao died, his belongings were moved to another house where there was a fire. And it seems that the most logical explanation is that the people who were clearing the house had no idea what was in there. And because they were slightly fire damaged, although not really, they just saw no worth in them and dumped them on the tip.
Yeah.
And it could so easily have been lost, because there has been no other recorded detailed mentions of the Sonora. There have been a few letters where it has been sort of mentioned in passing, and of course the airship sightings are like legendary, but the actual detailed descriptions of the craft and the people that were in it appear to be only documented by Del Shao and nearly lost forever.
I've got a couple of questions about the club. So the name is a location, or do we know, not know?
The name is a location, yes, yes.
And one question I, the other question I had was, do we know, is it ever recorded how many people were actually in this club?
Yeah, so sort of buried within the text are the names and detailed descriptions of, well, it recorded in the book that I've got in The Secrets of Del Shao. There's about 25, but they are not like just the only key members, right, by the looks of it. But yeah, Peter Menes, there's a picture of him here. He's even got a not just a drawing, but his name is written next to him, and he's got him. He's got a little hat and a pipe. You can see there. There's Peter Menes, yeah. And the description: Peter Menes designed and built the Aero Goosey in 1857, the very year that Del Shao met him. The Aero was the prototype of all subsequent Aeros. The motors for the Aero Goosey were made in 1856 also, and the work on the motors and even the Aero itself was started previously to the inception of the Aero Club. In the plate, the following notation: Goosey, Sonora, 1857, California. Have you ever heard of Peter Menes, Goose and his offspring? Peter, I haven't forgotten you. There's many others, like there's a chap called Michael Gore, who apparently was a friend of Peter Menes. He looks like a very cross individual. But next to them, it's almost like it's like a set of superheroes, because they all have their own specific craft. Right. So this chap drove the Aero Immer. Okay. You know, so it's like every single person has their sort of their favourite craft that they would... They either designed and built themselves, or they collectively built and put together. So it's like a collection of pilots and inventors. Yeah. So when they all come together, they've all got their own strange, weird little crafts.
It's a bit like Wacky Races.
It's completely like Wacky Races. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So there's another one here. So they do get quite detailed. There's a chap called August Immer. And he proposed the Aero Immer, apparently.
Yeah.
He made some changes to the design and later came up with the long-distance Aero Immer that was probably constructed in Colombia in 1858. His son, Heinrich Immer, helped with the construction of the airship. And another son was also a member of the Sonaro Air Club. And there's nothing known about him but his name. But you see, like... We don't know these people. Yeah, there's a huge amount of detail, but this is all derived from the code.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
25 at least members. That's still a sizable. Yeah, it's that Wacky Races thing. You just got this vision of them somewhere in California all getting together and just, you know, all right, let's go out for an afternoon jaunt. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. Like some of the. The craft, the descriptions are really wonderful. The Aero Warrior, there are six different drawings of this Aero, which includes details of the deck lay, and there's a plate 2394. It has very strange rooms called the Above Store, the Force Connection, the Loiter Room, the Magazine, the Grubs, and the Passage Hall, sorry.
Wow.
And the pleasingly named Aero Mary was an airship that, again, apparently was actually built, and appears on plate 2412. And the design of this was attributed to a man called, August Schottler. And the code reads that Eigner, or owner of the Aero Mary, was indeed August Schottler. But it's got a very, I can't really describe it, it's got a very flamboyant sort of, it looks like there's a hamster wheel to protect the person who is flying it from crashing into the earth. But so they're all, yes, you're right, Wacky Races type weird craft. But wouldn't it have been amazing that rather than just finding the documents, we'd have found the actual craft? Because
yeah, they must exist.
If they were built, they must
exist somewhere.
This is why Pete was so passionate about finding, you know, going through the code, buying the books, finding out all of these names. But like I say, the reason I focus on the fuel is because without the fuel... without the fuel, it's just completely made up.
Yeah.
But now there's a possibility that there's a fuel there. there's a possibility that the Sonora Aero Club existed, and there's a possibility that all of these previous UFO encounters, including with the nudists, were flights of fancy, if you'll pardon the pun, and that the steampunk UFOs were nothing more than actual aircraft designed by inventors who just hid from society.
Advanced technology.
And advanced technology, yes, yes.
Hell of a thing to see, wouldn't it, if they were all out? Because, I mean, I guess the whole, I guess it depends how the club works, but you've got to think at some point you'd have at least most of the people who had their crafts wanting to take them out on the same day. You would, wouldn't you?
I would have thought so.
There's a scenario as the member of the public, you just look up at the sky and there's all these weird creations going on. You know, one that's got a bit of a hamster wheel. You know, in my mind, one that looks very Jules Verne-y. It is just like wacky racers of the sky. You'd look up and go, what the heck is going on there?
Well, some of them even have kitchens in them.
I love that.
And if you remember, there was a UFO sighting where the pilots were making pancakes.
Right, yes, I remember that. Yeah. Yeah, and they shared the pancakes, didn't they?
They shared the pancakes, and they were disappointed that the pancakes were just normal Earth pancakes.
Yes.
This would explain it.
Yes. Wow.
It's not just the story of the Sonora Air Club. It's a story of, we're a step closer to thinking it's possible. And if I could recommend, if you want further reading, because it is quite detailed, this book, The Secrets of Dalshow by Dennis Crenshaw and P.G. Navarro, it's out on Anomalous Books. It's about 20 quid off Amazon, and it's 281 pages long. So you certainly get the full story, but all the plates that I've mentioned, you will find in there. It doesn't have all the plates from all the books, of course. That would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's got some very, very interesting illustrations. And I think you probably have to read the whole thing to make your mind up. I've obviously read the whole thing. I fall on the side of, I think it was a group of people who really wanted it to be true and were documenting their sort of, not their fantasy, but the fact of what they wanted to achieve.
Yeah.
I'm not sure any of it is true. That's just my personal interpretation, although I will say I don't understand what else could have caused the airship flaps.
Yeah.
But I just feel like it's too far-fetched, the designs and stuff. They still look too, they just don't look as if they would work. But then that's just my, you know, who what do I know?
But it's almost like we mentioned earlier, of it's science fiction, but it could be science fiction, but not in the terms of a narrative story. It's almost like the pre-research to a science fiction novel, or
yeah,
some kind of art project of wanting to, or like you said, maybe they wanted to create these things and just were experimenting with the ideas rather than the actual making them. Fascinating, though. You can see why this guy who found these books got completely obsessed with it. You would, wouldn't you?
Oh, you would. You would, especially after investing so much time and money. Once you've started, you can't go back. And going through the code, I think, is, you know, I think it's almost the code that drew him. And getting that sort of inkling of, maybe I could explain some of these things. Because, of course, we do try and explain current UAPs with breakaway civilization, as I previously said.
Yeah.
And maybe if you can prove that there was a previous breakaway civilization, it makes it more realistic that there is a current one.
Or even not as a high-end theory of that, of just like, I mean, I think I feel this a lot with the Tic Tac UFO sightings, that it's just technology that's there but is kept back because we don't need it at the moment. We don't need to admit to, you know, our enemies or whoever that we've got it, so we hold it back. It's a similar principle, isn't it? Either in a world where there was no internet, no, you know, cameras were rare, that, you know, you could have these little subsections of people creating things. I think your point about the French example of the Wright brothers flight, the one that preceded it, shows that, doesn't it? And we've had that with other inventions, you know, the light bulb, you know, everyone thinks Edison, but it wasn't, you know what I mean? We've had it with the telephone, Bell, but, you know, it was an Italian. It's almost like it's not who's first with this stuff. It's who's
loudest.
Who's loudest and who captures the imagination. So it's totally plausible that they could have created something ahead of its time.
Oh, yes, completely plausible.
And it would remain secret. But what I love about it is the whole narrative of that story of finding these books, what's in the books. You know, it is so Jules Verne, Edgar Allan Poe, the romance of early exploration, you know, even the ridiculousness of wacky races. It's kind of all in there. It's beautiful narrative, really.
The designs are very much 80 Days Around the Worldy.
Yeah.
Even the cover of this book, actually, if I wave it across the room at you.
Yeah, very much, yeah. And there's such a romance about that, isn't there? Because it was a time where anything must have felt possible and magical because the world wasn't as open as it is now.
100%, yes. It would be, if you could crack powered flight in the 1830s,
Yeah. You
had not only like a romantic possibility of exploration, but you had a military advantage as well.
Yeah.
A significant military advantage.
Yeah.
So there's many reasons to have done it.
But in a way, that's what makes it more romantic, I think, that almost feels like a secondary thing. But something like this now does feel like it would just be militarized immediately. Whereas back then, I don't know if it's an illusion on my part or the romantic in me, I feel this aero club could have existed with no military knowledge or interest in it. You know what I mean? And there's something romantic about that.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're absolutely right. And yeah, in a way, it's a real shame that we've lost it.
Yeah.
If you want to know more about it, read that. And then, like, I forgot to mention another book which I used as a little background reading. It's a little bit harder to get hold of. I had to buy it from somewhere that wasn't Amazon. Empire of the Wheel, Two Friends from Sonora by Walter Bosley. That's worth reading as well.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful story. Whether it's true or not doesn't really matter. There's something in it. You know, it's a bit like those. I feel a bit like on this story, a bit like I did about Jeff the Talking Mongoose. Doesn't really matter so much whether it's true or not. I know there's other implications if it is, but it's the romance of it and the story itself, which is just fascinating.
Jeff the Flying Mongoose.
Yeah, imagine that. That'd be good, wouldn't it? Imagine if Jeff was part of the Sonora Club.
Now, that is a twist that I would like to have seen.
Yeah.
And maybe the film should have been less lazy and had done that.
Yeah, or that could be Jeff the Talking Mongoose 2.
Look who's talking to another.
The flying years.
Yes. Well, you can't say that we don't have a multitude of topics on this show.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Yes.
That was, fascinating. Really good story. That it's funny because I know we've covered it loosely in the past, but I think this is brought it into a different angle of the way we've done it today. And it's the story itself that's just so fascinating. I mean, the whole thing is, again, talking to Jeff, it's movie script potential. I think you could see a beautiful, lovely film around that.
That's a good shout, actually.
Yeah.
I wonder who has got the movie rights.
Yeah, somebody must.
The Quantum Mechanics, Inc. need to...
We'll
find some money from somewhere.
Yeah.
Actually, speaking of which, patreon.com/TQMPod.
Oh, what a segue. That's fantastic. Yeah, we'll try and... we'll try and put some of the images that are out there on the Patreon site. And, if you go to Patreon, not only are you helping us out and keeping us going, we post the podcasts as soon as we've edited them there, so they're early, ad-free, and, there's some other stuff there. And there's lots of little community stuff going on, so it's well worth checking it out. Even if you can come and join for free to get some stuff, so you could always just come and become a free member. But obviously it'd be great if you'd become a mechanics assistant at a fiver, cheaper than a ammonia based half human size gas tank equipment. That's really bad, wasn't it? Really bad, kind of. So there's an incentive for you.
I give you 9 Aero Trumps out of 10.
Yeah. Oh, top Trumps, Sonara Aero edition.
Yes. Oh, there we go.
Beautiful, beautiful. Great. Well, look, next week, I'm working on something. Hopefully it's what I'm going to do. If it all goes to plan, Ben, I'm taking us under the waves next week.
Under the waves.
So we've been in the sky this week. We're going to go under the waves next week.
Human powered or?
Yeah, human powered. But think claustrophobia. Think no escape. Think weird stuff under the water.
Okay, I think I need my asthma inhaler.
Yeah, you might want to be prepared.
Okay, I will be. In that case, right, I'll go and prepare myself now. It'll take me a week.
Yeah, cool. All right, we'll be back next week. And thanks for listening. See you next week.
See you then. Bye.
Bye.
The quantum mechanics.